Well, we've been talking about the burial slab of the tomb of Jesus, apparently found in Jerusalem. Amazing story. Dr. Ken Hansen with us. His website, treasuresintime.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. A couple of his books include The Armageddon Code, The Visionaries, James and the Lost Heirs of Jesus. So much to talk about, and we'll be back with your calls and more on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Dr. Ken Hansen with us, and your calls. So, Ken, this latest discovery, we'll put it in quotes, what does that mean to everything we've studied about biblical prophecy, about the Bible? Does it bring it all home?
It means don't be so quick to dismiss the Bible.
Ha.
These things are ancient records and their texts. And when we have now even other texts that surface, for example, we talked about not only this little papyrus fragment, but also at exactly the same time, we're talking just within the last few weeks, couple of weeks, we've got new Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that.
Out of nowhere. It's like, you know, it's like the powers that be are trying to tell us something. Don't dismiss biblical text.
And it's as we get close to the holidays, all this stuff pops up. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and you couldn't time this. I mean, this is not by any human agency that it just happens to be close to the holidays. Got Hanukkah coming up here as well. It's really remarkable. New Dead Sea Scrolls. And my area of specialty is actually with the Dead Sea Scrolls. I wrote my dissertation on it. And even when it came to the scrolls, I said to myself, well, they've all been uncovered now. Nothing new is coming down the pike. And out of the blue, here we've got a whole series of additional Dead Sea Scrolls. At least 25 new ones have just been published. Fragments.
That's huge.
Yeah, but it is said that even these are just the tip of the iceberg, that there are more out there. At least 70 more of them have appeared in the antiquities market since 2002. That's huge. This is a major headline here. And there will be claims and counterclaims. When the scrolls were first released, now we're talking decades ago, the claims were, they're all forgeries. That's just what has been claimed about this new papyrus. It must be a forgery. Of course, when you've got carbon-14 dating, that helps a little bit. And then you also look at the science of paleography, which is handwriting analysis. This is a real science. If you're a Hebraic scholar, you can look at a line of ancient Hebrew text, and you can know within decades when that was actually penned. And every letter ought to be exactly in a certain style. Just like in English, you can look at the way certain English letters appear in print books, for example, where the letter F often looks like an S. I think you know what I'm talking about. And you know this dates from a certain time. That's paleography. And Hebrew is the same way. And when everything matches, when the carbon date matches the style of the letters, you know you're looking at authentic ancient material. You could not make this up. 25 new ones with rumored to be at least 70 more out there.
What will it take to get people to truly accept the fact that the Bible is the real deal?
I think no one has ever accepted that, and I'm not sure anyone ever will, or at least everybody ever will, because isn't that the nature of the human condition? Go back to the story of Jesus and the doubting Thomas. This is the nature of the human condition. People are hot-wired to ask questions. And actually, you know, George, I don't mind that. I'm a scholar, and I don't mind asking questions. I don't mind challenging, as long as it's a good challenge, as long as it's a scholarly challenge, a factual challenge. And that's something else about the Jewish psyche. Even to this day, everything is questioned. Everything. Jews are raised to ask questions, not to accept anything on blind faith. If a certain story is true, okay, prove it. You're the lawyer, as I tell my students. You walk into the court of public opinion, and you got to make your case. Here's the evidence. And by the way, the stones don't lie. But when it comes to the miraculous, as I said before, that really is a matter of faith. Christians believe certain things, Jews believe certain things, and who can prove, unless you had a video camera back there, what miracles happened and what didn't? But what we can do is look at the evidence, and we can ask if there's anything in the record that disproves a certain account. And that's an entirely different issue.
Jesus's campaign, he died, he was about 33 years old, I think, right? How old was he when he started the campaign? Was he 30? Was it like a three-year campaign of what
around,
he did?
Around that age, as a matter of fact, exactly. And what was he up to? That is also questioned. It's debated. I think that's a healthy thing. Was Jesus purely religious in his campaign? What was he, an ancient politician? Did he have political overtones?
Was he subversive?
Was he subversive? That's the subject of a major new PBS documentary, by the way, that I've just been asked to participate in. Was Jesus a political subversive? Was he an insurrectionist? Huge, huge issue. Personally, I thread the needle in that regard. I think that Jesus had to have been aware of the political elements of this Kingdom of Heaven movement that he was talking about. There was a political movement. They wanted to make Israel great again. Okay, it was a grassroots movement.
Did he raise Lazarus from the dead?
Another interesting question. I have a friend who's a very prominent British archaeologist, the very fellow who discovered the gate where Pilate would have tried Jesus in the archaeology, major discovery. He has written that such stories about raising Lazarus are not out of the question, even from an archaeological standpoint, because people in antiquity, they dropped like flies. There was a serious death rate. People were diseased. They were dying of all manner of disease and various causes. And sometimes they were actually buried before being dead. It would pass out, and people would think that they were dead, and they were not. They were simply comatose. Edgar Allan Poe wrote this famous short story about the premature burial, and sure enough, you had that happening in the ancient world. So my colleague's view is that Jesus probably had expertise in this regard of knowing who was really dead, who was comatose. It's not inconceivable that someone who was in a comatose state, for example, could have been brought back by someone who knew exactly the arts of healing, as Jesus of Nazareth certainly did.
All right, let's take some calls for the rest of the night now. We will pick it up by going to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Scott's turn on Coast to Coast. Scott, go ahead.
I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure thing.
Ken, I've got something very interesting that you might... Ron Wyatt done an archaeology dig back in the mid-90s for the Ark of the Covenant. Now, he was in Jerusalem, and... he claims divine guidance led him to a spot that was 2,000 years of a trash heap that had been dumped on top of this site. He started digging there. There was a series of tunnels underneath all this rubble. Now, we're talking 2,000 years worth of rubble. And as it turns out, he finally found one tunnel that had the Ark of the Covenant in it. Two angelic beings were standing by the Ark of the Covenant. They allowed him to take a pop cap, you know, a cap off of a, you know, flip-top lid off of a bottle, can of pop, you know. He took a blood sample off the top of the Ark of the Covenant, which Jesus Christ, the cross, stood right there, right above the Ark of the Covenant. And as he was hanging on the cross, the blood dripped down on the Ark of the Covenant. The angelic beings allowed him to take a sample of the blood. He took it back home and ran a sample on it, a lab sample, and it turned out to be one parent, proving mother, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. It was a virgin birth, just like the King James Bible tells you it is. You've got to have blind faith, man. The Bible tells you, believe as a child without question. And you can't teach someone that. You either have that ability or you don't.
I had not heard about this. Ken, have you?
I've heard of Ron Wyatt and some of his work, And I tried to keep an open mind about things, but again, coming from a Jewish perspective, we don't just accept everything. We're in that court of public opinion. So we ask questions and we say, great, this is terrific. Now show me the evidence. Show me, show me, show me. You got a photograph, for example. Where was this object found? Always a question of it. Is it in situ? Was it in the place where it was actually deposited so many hundreds and centuries ago? Or did it just appear suddenly in the antiquities market? But the trouble is here, we don't have any serious documentation from anybody. I'm saying, show me, all right? I want to see this Ark of the Covenant. The bottom line is there are multiple theories. I have another friend, also from Oklahoma, who thinks that the Ark may be inside a cave in the vicinity of Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls
right.
were found.
And I also hear it could be in a church in Ethiopia. You've heard that one.
That's another one. This colleague of mine is also searching for the famed copper scroll treasure that was highlighted exactly in a copper document discovered out near the Dead Sea in one of those caves, a listing of over 200 tons of gold and silver and consecrated objects apparently from the ancient temple. And might this include the Ark of the Covenant? That's my Oklahoma friend's theory. And he actually has friends and supporters in Israel. Some of them are in the Israeli government, as a matter of fact. Very interesting. He has rabbi friends who are seriously involved in looking for this, and they think they have an area and a cave that they are trying to get permission to excavate in to see if this treasure and perhaps the Ark might be there. Well, we're waiting. We're waiting. And my opinion is, hey, I'm open-minded and no problem in digging whatsoever. And however fantastic something may sound, fantastic things like 25 new Dead Sea Scrolls crop up all the time. So go ahead and dig. If we find it, great. I'm down. I'm open-minded. But I want to see. I want some evidence. And oftentimes these ideas and these sensational theories float around out there. And sadly, they end up discrediting some of them, what we're trying to do. Because if something then doesn't materialize, well, then the whole thing must be bogus. There maybe is no tomb of Jesus under the Holy Sepulchre, and on it goes. That's where we're at. That's why we have to ask questions and be so very careful not to discredit the very things that we're trying to prove.
Joe in the Bronx, welcome to the show. Joe.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Ken if he knows anything further about the drinking cup from the Last Supper, which I believe is being held in a Catholic church in Valencia, Spain. It's been used in masses by John Paul II, who's now a saint, and Pope Benedict.
Tough question. Again, where's the evidence? I want to see an archaeological validation, all right? There are ways that archaeologists can look at objects and really have a good sense of exactly how old. I tend to be hesitant about anything found in Europe, for example, especially with the Da Vinci Code theory that the descendants of Jesus ended up somehow going across into continental Europe and so on and so forth. The farther we go into that theory, the more tenuous and less authentic we can say that it is. And there's a lot of Christian traditions, again, about various artifacts and holy relics, but you got to prove it. You got to prove it. Even the Shroud of Turin, I think, is pretty well established now as, I'm sorry to say, bogus. When you get on firm ground, it's not when you're in Europe, I'm afraid, but it's when you're right there where it happened, in the land of Israel, in Jerusalem. That's when you start to get the real goosebumps, and that's what we have to separate out.
All right, next up.
I'm quizzical about that.
John in St. Louis. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Love the show.
Thank
and Ken,
sir.
Good morning to you. I'm glad you have an open mind. I wanted to, something like this does take faith, but as the Bible says, but I'm a total believer that Jesus defied the laws of physics because he wrote the laws of physics. And what do you think about using logic, these two points? One, a major magazine, Newsweek, Time, one of them years ago, a few years ago, whole magazine was on that month was for historical Jesus. And they went to the town of Bethany, and they ended their whole thing with this thought that in the town of Bethany, where Lazarus was arose, they changed the name of the town. It was something else 2,000 years ago. So this big event happens in that town, so they changed the entire name of this town. All the signs had to be changed to a new name, and that name translates from what it is now to where Lazarus arose. So using logic, they reasoned that the whole town would not change the name of the town on a falsehood. So that's that one point. And the second point is what about using logic? You take 12 disciples, they run for their lives after their leader's taken away and crucified. They're scared for their lives. What on earth would make them to do a 180-degree turn and go out in public? They're not scared of death anymore at all. What would make a human being do that except for the fact that they actually physically touched and saw him come back to life? From then on, a human being would not be afraid of death at all. What do you think about that using logic?
Well, as I say, it's a riddle wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma, this whole thing is. And again, I represent a Judaica program, and again, I'm open-minded, right? The question is, as you say, what would cause a people who were followers of Jesus, who had been scattered, whose leader had just been executed, and there were numbers of messianic characters, by the way, and this is important to point out, in the days of Jesus, both before and after. One of them actually went up on top of the Mount of Olives and claimed that he could blow down the walls of Jerusalem by his breath. Another one claimed that he could part the waters of the River Jordan, like had happened long ago in the days of the Exodus. And the Romans regularly dispatched them. They decapitated them, executed them. The historian Josephus writes about this in ancient times. He says, and their followers were scattered and dispersed. And when you read in the account of the book of Acts, where the now movement of Jesus, the disciples of Jesus, are in trouble with the Sanhedrin, and we're told that one of the leaders of the Jewish court, the Sanhedrin, named Gamaliel, famous Jewish sage, Orthodox, faithful Jew, he stands up and he points this out. You see, there have been other messiahs who have come and gone, and their followers have been scattered. And he points out to the Jewish court, he says, look, if this is not of God, this messiah of yours, then the same thing will happen.
All right, Ken, hold on. We're going to come back for final questions. By the way, this just in, former U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno is dead at the age of 78. And welcome back. George Norrie back with Ken Hansen, our final segment here. Ken, your website, of course, treasuresintime.org for people to go to. You are always updating it and quite busy, aren't you?
Always quite busy. In fact, I'm going to be leading yet another group to Israel next May. If you're interested in seeing some of the things we've been talking about on the show tonight, the actual tomb, we believe it's there. We believe it's been found, of Jesus of Nazareth. Not to mention the exact place. I'm certain of it. My friend, the archaeologist from Britain, found it, where Jesus stood trial before Pontius Pilate. These are the kind of things, by the way, that people don't see in their standard tour of Israel. People don't even know where this trial of Jesus is located. People go by it all the time. They have no idea it's there. So you have to go with the right person. And so it's wide open to anyone who wants to accompany us next May.
Do you believe that Jesus indeed committed miracles and perform them?
Let me say, I don't doubt it. If he was a Hasid, a pious Orthodox, if he were around today, he'd be an Orthodox Jew, very kosher, and very much faithful. He had a kind of relationship with the divine that got him into trouble, frankly.
this is exactly the kind of person that you would expect to have miraculous powers. Of course, I can't prove it. I'm a scholar, and we can't go there in academe, but I have no reason to doubt or to deny that miracles happen, that miracles take place, and that the Almighty, I'm talking outside of my scholarly role now, still performs miraculous events, things, happenings in lives today.
When you hear stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, Moses parting the Red Sea, what do you think happened, Ken?
Oh, my goodness. How many shows do we have
to
talk about all of this? And again, that's why I love asking questions. Yes, childlike faith is nice. It's very, especially if you want to get into this kind of mystical kingdom of heaven sense and feeling that Jesus was talking about. But when it comes to the brass tacks of what happened, establishing what happened, we got to put on a different hat there. We got to put on our Sherlock Holmes hat and start digging and investigating. And I can tell you that the questions regarding such things as the Exodus, Moses, the parting of the Red, all this stuff is swirling around now as much as ever, if not more. The conquest of Canaan. Were there ever Israelites in Egypt? I'm on the side of those who say yes. There was an Exodus, but I've got to prove it. We can't just say, well, I believe it because that's what I've been taught. No, I've got to get in there in the court of public opinion, and I've got to prove it. And that's where the archaeology comes in. In fact, I'm pioneering a whole new online course that it will be all about biblical archaeology, and we want to produce this with video episodes weekly to take people through all these questions that are swirling around and what we can prove, what we can't.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We go to Jeff in Culver City, California. Jeffrey, go ahead. Hey, Jeff. No Jeff. Where'd he go? Let's try him one more time. Jeff, you there? No, he's gone. Let's go to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland, though. Hey, Frank, go ahead.
Howdy, George. Glad to be back with you. This week marks 9 years with you.
Good. Thank you.
About my faith and everything else.
Perfect.
And I want to ask you, I know you're familiar with the name Phinehas.
Yes.
One of Moses' generals. We had a kid in St. Joseph's elementary school had the name Phinehas, and for some reason the kids made fun of him. Well, anyway, Phinehas was one of Moses' generals. Correct me wherever I'm wrong. Moses ordered him to kill every man, woman, and child in Canaan. But I later learned on this show that they did that because they were the offspring of giants. So, and the God I know wouldn't command someone to kill innocent men, women, and children. But what do you know of that? And on the sidelight, I support the great state of Israel 100%, except for the Johnson Pollard fiasco. Thank you for coming on this show. And if I get my money together, I'm gonna try to go to Israel with you.
Beautiful, beautiful. In Jewish tradition, we call him Pinchas ben Elazar, and that gets rudely translated to Phinehas, which is, I'm sure, why a person with that name gets teased, unfortunately. And Israel is a nice name, Pinchas ben Elazar, strong, tough. But I can tell you that in Jewish tradition, there's a lot of debate about him, and he's not treated always so kindly, as a matter of fact, because he is one who shed a lot of blood. Giants or not, we can talk about giants another time. That's another huge issue. But we're talking about Canaanites. We're talking about a command to annihilate human beings. Now, Jewish tradition recognizes that this kind of thing happened in antiquity. If you're taking a land, if you're taking a promised land, then you need to be military. There's no way. If you have a strong military, we talk about that even today. A military is designed, I'm sorry, to kill people, and that's what happens. If you have a land to take, then sometimes that's unavoidable. But even so, Jewish tradition never rejoices in the death of anybody, even one's enemies. And Pinchas, I'm afraid, is taken to task in Jewish commentaries for his role in bloodletting. Jews are very sensitive about this because there really is a respect for life, for all human life, and as we mentioned on the show, even for the dead.
Next up, let's go to Joel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Joel, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
How you doing, George and Dr. Hansen? Thanks, and thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy your work. I've been listening to you for a few years, and I like your perspective of what you do, and it's really interesting. I was really fortunate. Actually, me and my daughter, we were able to go to Israel, to Jerusalem a few years ago, and we went to the tomb of Jesus, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and it was really beautiful. And I can kind of relate what you're saying. And on that, I just, there was a story, I don't know if you heard, and it was a renowned rabbi named Yitzhak Kaduri, and basically a renowned scholar, a rabbi that he said, and he wrote on a note that he sealed it for a year, and he wrote on that note that the name of the Messiah was Yeshua. Jesus, any opinions on that, sir? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
I am familiar with that account. And like so many other things, it's difficult exactly to come to a conclusion. Was the note authentic? We don't take anything for granted. We ask questions. When was the note written? How authentic was it? Is it something that really says Yeshua? Yeshua also, by the way, means salvation. It just means salvation. Which happens to have been the name of Jesus. But because you have the word salvation, that doesn't necessarily indicate that this person was a believer in Jesus as the Messiah. Again, we're coming from the Jewish world, and these things are very, very touchy, right? And we can't make a proclamation this person or that person was the Messiah. If he believed it, okay, that's his opinion. I'm familiar with the account, but I also have to say the jury is out on that one. Just as in these Dead Sea Scroll fragments, there are naysayers, there are those who say it's not authentic, he didn't write it, and so on and so forth. Comes back to a matter of one's personal religion, which I respect, one's personal faith perspective, and I think we need to be open to each other's faith perspectives, not say mine is right, yours is wrong, et cetera, et cetera. Hope that helps.
Ken, is Jerusalem safe nowadays?
I've lived there for a long time, and I've had some hair-raising experiences. Even recently, I've taken tours there. There have been occasional flare-ups. There have been stabbings. There have been some serious incidents. But I can also say that there are far fewer incidents than there are in a place like Chicago, for example. The people I escort there, generally I have to try to explain to them it's a safe place, nothing to worry about, nothing to get antsy about. And after the tour is over, they say, well, my goodness, what was I ever concerned about? I felt safer there than I've ever felt anywhere. People are taken good care of in the state of Israel and in the city of Jerusalem. But I tell you, there is real trouble brewing. And I was just, in fact, even this evening, looking at one of my favorite passages from the prophet Zechariah that says, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of staggering unto all peoples, or a cup of reeling unto all peoples. That's how it says it in the English. In the Hebrew, it says safra'al, which is a cup of poison.
Oh, geez.
Which says it a lot more strongly, doesn't it? And isn't that exactly the way so many nations view the state of Israel today and the city of Jerusalem? The English dances around, well, it causes you to stagger. No, it's poison. And it's going to get worse. It's going to get a lot worse as we go forward, because the nations tend to align themselves, don't they, against Israel. And when you go on in the prophet Zechariah, it says, I will make Jerusalem a stone of burden for all the peoples. all that burden themselves with it shall be sore wounded, and all the nations of the earth shall be gathered together against it. I mean, this was written millennia ago by the prophet Zechariah, and here in the 21st century, we've got exactly that sort of thing transpiring. It does give you goosebumps, and it's enough to scare you, quite frankly, like a horror movie. But I appreciate the guests who say that I stand with Israel, and I think we need that. I think especially here in the United States, Israel doesn't have many friends. The United States has historically been a great friend of Israel and needs to continue to be.
Let's go to Larry in Waco, Texas, first-time caller. Good morning, Larry.
Well, good morning, George.
Hi.
I called the other night as a first-timer. I was suggesting that I had gotten some proof that we're in the tribulation right now.
Yes.
And the scriptures say that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. So part of our problem is that the King James Version that a bunch of us use is not accurate enough for us to get some of the ideas that are there. And this is a translation problem, you know, and a religious thing from 1611. But the what I do to get around that is I use the Hebrew and the Greek. And so what I found is, that, among other things, is that man is not the original inhabitant of the earth, and the earth is older. So if you go back to Genesis 1, between 1 and 2, you have a gap. So in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and then there's a gap there that you got a word there that could have been translated different. So instead of saying that the earth became waste and empty, or was, instead of was empty, you can also translate it became empty. So this was a period of time when the demons, who were the first inhabitants of the earth, it was that creation of the earth and the demons with their bodies, spirits and bodies, that Satan was attracted to. That is when he rebelled.
Let's get a quick take from you, Ken, as the minutes of the show are clicking by here.
Yeah, Genesis 1's fascinating, and there is a suggestion that there was something there pre-existent already. This idea of creation ex nihilo, out of nothing, isn't really in the Hebrew text. There was a formless void that God then took and made into something, and we can get all into astrophysics, in fact, at that point. And in terms of other beings and angelic and demonic beings, I can tell you that the Jewish Talmud, which Christians, sadly, are not generally familiar with. These are volumes of rabbinic writings composed of centuries from Jesus' time onward, have all sorts of reference to Satan and to demons galore, although Judaism historically has de-emphasized those. We don't want to go there. We don't want to talk really about Satan and demons because, after all, the most important phrase in Judaism is Deuteronomy 6:4, Hear, O Israel, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Eloheinu Hashem Echad, the Lord our God is one. One. Not multiple, not many. We're not pagans. We don't have a host of demons. We've got one God who is all-powerful and all-just. And that, ultimately, is where Judaism came down. So even while Jewish literature talks and references demons and Satan and so on, we have to be careful. We have to be careful because we have one God, not many.
Ken, as we wrap things up, your website again, treasuresintime.org, and if people are interested in taking this trip with you, what do they do?
Just click on my website. There's a link there that will take you right to the tour operator who's organizing the tour, and you can also email me. You can click and you can email me and let me know that you're interested. I'm really, really excited about this. Jews are coming, Christians are coming, and this is what I do, right? I teach Jews, I teach Christians, and I do it in a way that's not offensive, hopefully, to anybody. We have to be respecting each other's faith traditions. That's what I try to do every time I'm on the show with you, George, and that's why I appreciate you so much.
All right, Ken, thank you so much. Be safe wherever you go, okay?
Definitely. Sure will, George.
Dr. Ken Hansen reacting to the incredible story that the tomb of Jesus might have been found. What a great story. I mean, absolutely great story. Well, stick with us all week long. We'll be here with a series of great coast-to-coast programs. Don't forget Tuesday, election night, 5 hours of live programming, and then it'll be over. unless it goes to Congress and they've got to pick one. We'll see. That's a possibility. For Juan Velasquez, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.